If you're an athlete, you know the greatest motivator of all is the fear of letting your teammates down. After all, a team is only as good as its weakest link. So you owe it to those wearing the same jersey as you to be your best every time you step on the field. That's why there's no vape in team. When you vape, you can expose your lungs to toxic chemicals that can damage your lungs. If you're a step behind, the team's a step behind. Brought to you by The Real Cost and the FDA.
We are live with a completely unnecessary podcast for Wednesday, February 19th, 2014, alongside my always bespectacled and hoodied friend, Ian Ferguson.
You know, I don't wear hoodies in the summer.
My name is Pat Contry. Of course you do. How's everyone doing? Ian, how you doing today?
Life is dandy.
You're saying a little facetiously, I think.
Yeah, you know, 2014 is the year that just keeps on trucking on. So that's good.
But it's barely started. We're not even 1/6 done with
it. Yep, and it's just, you know...
It's shitty.
It's bullshit after bullshit.
Yeah, it really is.
So, anyway, that's enough of that.
Coming up on the show, we're going to discuss a few things. Irrational Games closing after, 17 years. We're going to discuss, on YouTube, issues Total Biscuit being falsely flagged for copyright because of a bad game review. We're going to be talking about NES games, the morality of having repro games and buying them, and label replacements, and is NES no longer fun to collect because it's expensive and hard? We'll also probably get into a little bit about the upcoming Guardians of the Galaxy movie, the trailer was just released yesterday, and a couple other fun topics, and if we have time for your Q&A, we'll take a few questions via hashtag CU podcast on Twitter. So what's been going on for this week for me? Doing some writing. I'm still planning the next NES Punk episode. There's been a lot of other crap going on the side, including us filming for Video Game Heroes 1984. That had to do that. So
that was fun.
There should be a new NES Punk episode. God damn, there should be a new one by March 1st. And the good news is I'm writing and shooting two at the same time, so there'll probably be two in the month of March. If one doesn't come out in February, it'll be two in March. Two in March for sure. So I'm going to shoot them both at the same time. And then I have other plans for other stuff and maybe a new show. Super Riff Brothers, 3 out of 4 episodes are out. The third episode came out today. Go watch it. It's Nintendo customer service training. And next week's the season 1 finale of that with Pro Jared and Brennan Floss, my two friends. So, Irrational Games. These are the guys behind Bioshock.
Even further back, the people behind System Shock, which was huge on the PC in the late 90s. And they are closing their doors after they release the second part of the Bioshock Infinite DLC, Burial at Sea Part 2. I think this is noteworthy for a couple of reasons, and I think both reasons kind of take the conversation in different directions, so I'll make my two bullet points. One, this is, I think, further proof of why the modern idea of a quote-unquote AAA game or a AAA game studio is bad. These studios cannot support the weight of what they're producing anymore.
Really?
When Capcom calls something like 5 million sales of Resident Evil 6 a failure, when something like Bioshock Infinite gets the critical acclaim and the sales that it does, and these studios still have to shutter, that means they can't support themselves anymore.
So what's going on there? Is the fact that they're just bloated? Is too many employees, too much overhead? Since there's so many expectations of these big budget AAA titles, that if only one falters a little bit, the whole thing collapses.
Let me try to phrase it as directly as I can. For instance, Bioshock Infinite was supposed to initially have multiplayer modes.
Okay.
All throughout Bioshock Infinite's development, there was talk of these modes that they had planned and that they had pulled out of the game. Bioshock, System Shock, the Shock games in general have always been heavily narrative focused. They've been first person, but the focus hasn't always... Nothing about any Shock game has ever screamed to me, this would be great in multiplayer. Okay?
Sure.
So why are you going to try to shoehorn multiplayer into something? You've wasted all that time, money, and resources on trying to put something into a game that doesn't need to be there. And then you pull it out. It's money wasted. So yes, it's overreaching on the part of these AAA studios to feel like they have to include everything inside one game. There has to be side quests.
Well,
there has to be...
They're going for the entire market.
Right.
They're going for the multiplayer folks. They're going for the single-player story folks. The cinema. And now, unfortunately, now games are planned and they're also produced as big budget movies.
Right. But all I'm saying is we've gotten to the point where these games are costing more than what they're worth, and we're not even seeing in the final product some of these things that this money has been spent on.
Sure.
It's poor planning, it's poor spending, it's idiotic. You look at something like, and I didn't like it as much as past efforts, it's like maybe even Oblivion and Morrowind, but look at something like Skyrim, which just refused to put a multiplayer aspect in. Why? There's no way they could do it, and it didn't siphon off their resources. You know, it's smart thinking. Don't put multiplayer into something that doesn't need or beg of multiplayer. Everything that's a first-person shooter, and I'm focusing too much on multiplayer now, but everything that's a first-person shooter feels like they have to put it in, but you know what? The servers are dead in a month and a half's time. Why? Because everyone goes back to Halo or Call of Duty. So stop trying. A first-person shooter is not going to... You're not going to pull a significant enough piece of that pie away from Call of Duty or Halo or whatever the other first-person shooter is to warrant you putting this money in. So back to the original point, stop trying to put things in that are just going to get scrapped and cost money. The other thing is, you know, I don't want to say decadence, and I don't know a whole lot about Irrational, but one of the pictures that's been going around shows a giant life-size statue of a Big Daddy from BioShock, you know, sitting in the front office, and everything is well-designed and nicely designed. And I think it's this situation where some of these companies start living outside of their means and they get bloated and, you know, but the higher-ups want more out of them, and then they can't.
That comes from the top, though. The fact of the matter is, if you're running a business, you're managing something, you have to know how to spend your money wisely. You have to know how to plan ahead.
Right, that's what I'm saying, and I don't think any of these video game companies really know how to do that.
So there's basically, I don't want to say they don't know what they're doing, but there's some trouble in terms of maybe it's a video game culture where everyone sees another big EA and they want to be the big, everyone wants to be EA, everyone wants to be, you know, Ubisoft, when really they should try to just hunker down and streamline and just make games and hopefully not go belly up like these guys.
And I think there's a disconnect too between what they think we want and what players actually want.
Sure. We've been saying that for years. I mean, everyone's been saying that.
Once again, you look at something like BioShock Infinite that came out in a form that most people were happy with. I know a lot of people who didn't like it, and I've never played it, but had that been their goal going in, this streamlined, focused sort of idea that they wanted to create, they could have done it with less manpower and less money, and people wouldn't be out jobs. The second problem I have with this is how it's been phrased, and I'm not going to crucify the guy yet, because I feel like I feel like there's a lot of stuff that hasn't been said, but the way Ken Levine, the head of Irrational, has kind of worded this is that he no longer wants to work with a big game company, so he's just going to lay all these people off, and he's going to take 15 people and he's going to start a smaller game company because that's going to allow him to do what he wants to do, which is make narrative-focused games.
Versus selling the company to someone else, or versus splitting it and then giving up ownership? And that just sounds fishy, doesn't it?
Well, it does. It does. It sounds like someone else is... sounds like someone else is forcing his hand. But that's got to be the worst way to announce, like, 200-plus people out of a job, is be like, you know what, I don't need all you to make these games. I'm just going to grab a smaller piece of the pie and, you know, go do this on my own. The thing with Irrational, though, is I think it got so linked to Levine that when you get these big-name developers, right, who head up these companies, when they leave, too many people look at that as the company gone. So Irrational without Levine is not Irrational, is basically what I'm getting at.
According to this article, Levine has chosen to hand over the BioShock series to 2K for further development.
Right, which is how they handled BioShock 2, which got panned. Well, I don't know if it got panned, but it certainly didn't turn out well.
It was somewhat of a cash-in.
Yeah, yeah. So, you know, I mean, that's what you can expect from the BioShock series from this point forward. The brains behind it is gone.
And maybe all the artistic sort of direction that made it original in the first place.
So
you want this is his here's his comment. There's no way from Levine, Ken Levine. There's no great way to lay people off, and our first concern is to make sure that the people who are leaving have as much support as we can give them during this transition. Besides financial support, the staff will have access to the studio for a period of time to say their goodbyes and put together their portfolios. Other Take-Two studios will be on hand to discuss opportunities within the company, and we'll be hosting a recruiting day inside their own studio, I guess, where we'll be giving third-party studios and publishers a chance to hold interviews with departing Irrational staff.
You just got shit canned, but let's have a job fair with free donuts before you take off. The truth of the matter is, in video games, this is how it works people don't necessarily get... A lot of those people in that 200 probably were not permanent members of Irrational. And this is part of the problem with game development as it is now. These guys who do all this work, these guys and girls who do all this work, they don't have any fucking job security. Mm-hmm. They get hired on for the duration of a game, and then it's, well, too bad, you have to go find another job.
Yeah,
but
it's almost like, it's almost like they're you know, contract jobs, but not really.
Yeah, but now, you know, the entire studio is getting disbanded, which just makes matters worse. So my heart goes out to anyone who's been affected by this. If there's anything I've learned about studios being disbanded, it's that other studios look out for other programmers, you know, graphic designers, artists, everyone in the field. They really look out for each other, and I think a lot of these people are going to land on their feet.
Sure.
And that's good. What's bad is the video game model that has got us to this point where this is a regular occurrence.
Well, yeah, I mean, I look at it. Once you get to this large level, like I said, it's almost like a movie company. So from job to job, you could have the same core team set for certain parts of the game. You'll have one, hopefully, team of the 3D modelers. You know, one could be the art design. You know, one part could be, you know, the gameplay. I don't know. You see what I mean? There'll be teams that move from job to job, hopefully.
Sure, but I kind of get what you're saying. Like, if each team moves as a unit and they get some clout and some name for themselves, but
yeah,
it would be better for everyone if... You could just, if each studio can nail down their core, there'd be consistency among games, you know, there'd be consistency among sequels, you know, in that sort of environment, creative things grow. I mean, that's
you're saying it may not happen enough.
That's how Irrational happened, you know? I mean, like, they got there by having core people. Bullfrog was a solid development house for so long because, you know, they worked with similar people in the same teams, and they got these great ideas that started in one game and matured in another game, and you
sure,
when you fragment the industry up like that, you're not going to get that.
So, end of an era, I guess? Well, I mean, they're still going to put out some Bioshock games in the future, but they won't be the same.
Well, yeah, Irrational's putting out the last DLC, like I said. They'll put out Bioshock... 2K will put out Bioshock games, and, you know, Ken Levine's team is going to move on and do digital releases that are going to be narrative-focused. And the only good thing I can say, the only thing that I can hope that comes out of this is that Levine, and I don't want to think he is, but isn't as egocentric as what's being printed makes him sound. But two, maybe this is what needs to happen before we start and we get back to a good spot in this. Maybe we do need to see a lot of this happen where people hunker down and focus into 15-person teams where they all are on the same page and they make these games. And maybe that'll last. Maybe that's a relationship that'll last. Maybe his new 15-person unit will be far more rock solid. Do you get what I'm saying? Like,
but can you put out, let's just say there's a new Bioshock game, would you be able to put that out with a 15-person team? A game of that scale?
I don't know. No, you wouldn't be able to. But what I'm saying is, I mean, I'm hoping we're getting to the point where maybe from the ground up, people will pick and choose a little bit better and end up with teams that they want to keep for the long run.
Hmm.
I don't know. Right, it sucks. I'm tired of flipping on the computer every month and seeing that 200 people in the video game industry that just put out a game that sold millions of fucking copies are out of jobs.
The bad part about it, too, is that it sort of stunts creative growth because you're going to try to play it safe and do, like we always make fun of, Call of Duty sort of franchise where they put out the same game every year because they know it's financially viable and don't go into artistic direction.
Well, but this turned out, it seemed like this was financially viable, but yes, you're kind of on the same page as what I was saying earlier.
But it wasn't, though, because it wasn't like you were seeing a Bioshock game even every 3 years. They, you know, there's the amount of space in between was larger.
Oh, no, it was. You know? What I'm saying is it stunts creative growth. Yes, that's what I'm trying to say. Like, if you keep moving people around and you can't keep one group of people focused on one idea or one story arc, it's never going to blossom into what you hope it's going to blossom into. And yeah, you're just going to get cookie cutter bullshit.
All right. So hopefully these 200 plus employees have a good donut job fair.
I think it might even be more. I don't have the full number of people let go. I want to say it was in the 200 to 250 range.
But you're saying in general, this does not bode well for the industry.
No, I don't think it bodes well.
I mean, that happens with a lot of things. There's always bloat, and then it comes back. I like to always compare it to movies, because that's exactly what that is. I mean, there was a period in the 70s where the power went away from Hollywood to smaller, more independent auteurs, you know. And then it boomerangs back to big blockbuster movies. And now we're sort of in a spot where, fortunately, with crowdsourcing, you can have, for both games and movies, you can have stuff that's more compact, you know, and more artistic vision, and you get to directly say, hey, this is what we want to see, and put the money to that. So who knows? Who knows what will happen in the future?
Anyway.
Moving on. We're having a frustrating day in general. So what's going on with Total Biscuit on YouTube?
So Total Biscuit is a YouTube reviewer. Most people know of him, British fellow, and he does a lot of reviews. He also covers a bunch of indie games, and he has a segment called WTF. This is not the first time he's gotten into this sort of problem. He reviewed a game a while back called Day One Gary's Dilemma or something like that, okay. And it was awful. He kind of took some cracks at it, did a video, and the people flagged him.
Why don't you explain what Total Biscuit, what he actually does?
So he's a YouTube reviewer who reviews PC games.
He has a huge following.
Huge following.
250,000 about?
Why this matters is, before we get into the rest, is, and this is true for lots of people, Pat, the majority of this guy's money comes through
ad revenue.
YouTube.
Yes.
Through ad revenue, okay? You can get a strike on your YouTube account for breaking copyright.
Not even, right.
Or being allegedly breaking copyright. You get, three strikes, and they can shut down your entire account, which means that your entire source of revenue, your job, your livelihood, your income is fucked. So, anyways, that's Total Biscuit. He's dry, he's sarcastic, he's fairly humorous. He recently did a review of a game called Guys of the Wolf by a company called Fun... Jesus, I don't even remember. Fun Something. I mean, they're
Fun Something.
Fun Something. And he got a strike placed on his account. He assumed that Fun Whatever put the strike on their account, on his account, because he had given it a negative review.
Sure.
They claimed that that was not the case. He then received a threatening email from them saying that he does not know who they are, and they can shut down his entire channel, and they have all the money in the world, and they can fly lawyers over to the UK if they need to make this a real claim.
So, basically, just because he didn't give a good review.
Right. This company, as it was later shown, is basically a bunch of, we don't know how old they are, but it's essentially a bunch of rich kids. Developed the game, and put it out, and it's awful, and he reviewed it, and now he got a strikeout, and the thing is like I said, it's beyond his livelihood at stake. It's entered bullying, and a bad review can hurt, but it's not taking away someone's entire source of income, sure, which is what these people are aiming to do.
All right, let's back up a second. So, the later half of last year, it was announced that basically flagging of material on YouTube would go back to the way it used to be. So basically what would happen in the past was you'd submit a YouTube video and it doesn't go through a person screening it. What happens is it's automated. It checks for video, checks for audio matches of stuff, I guess, in their massive library of people that sign on to YouTube to say, hey, this is our material, we want to see if it's flagged. And also even images to some extent. So how it used to be was, if you're on a network, and I believe he's a part of GameStation.
I think he's Polaris.
Polaris, which was, it's the GameStation.
Okay.
Maker Studios is the umbrella.
Yes, yeah. And Maker Studios, by the way, verified that it was the games company that flagged it.
So if you're a part of one of these networks, I'm part of one. Most of the big YouTubers, I'd say 99%, are part of these networks. It used to give you protection. It gave you a layer of protection, of like a buffer, if you will. Because before, you get attacked by a big studio, or sometimes they would just take your ad revenue, and they let you know this is copyright flagged, but they're going to be, we're still going to show ads, but part of the deal is you can show the video, but this company, I'll tell you the company, they're basically going to take the ad revenue. They wouldn't tell you that they're taking all or some of it, but you can check your own stats, and if you're getting none from it, you're getting none from it. For example, I'm on Nintendo Hemium Rhapsody song to Brent Flaws. I don't make any money on that. That's claimed. That's claimed. They used to be claimed by EMI, who actually didn't, I don't think, own the rights, but then now it's claimed, I think, by Freddie Mercury's estate. Either way. So what happened was before is that you had a buffer of protection. So they'd have to go through your network reps in order to strike down your account. That changed in the later half of last year. So all of a sudden, literally overnight, some networks told their producers, some didn't for whatever reason, some were bad. All of a sudden, you wake up, dozens of flags. All of a sudden, all your videos making money, they're not making money, and now all of a sudden, you have to go fight these. It's a burden. Burden proof is now on you.
Right.
That's part of the issue with this whole flagging system now, is that anyone, and I mean, a lot of people were getting flagged for stuff that wasn't even flagged by the original game company. They were flagged by these other third parties coming in and nefariously claiming all this stuff was theirs when it wasn't. That was a big mess, and that's probably still going on. That was a big mess the first couple of months. So I'm guessing what happened here is that his buffers, total business buffer protection is gone. So these guys are saying, well, like I said, we have money, we have lawyers, we don't like the review, let's just snap our fingers, and that video is pulled, which is obviously bullshit.
Right.
Because there is something called fair use when it comes to reviews and using footage of a game.
Yeah.
So I've been somewhat lucky myself personally. And the reason a lot of people made these big YouTube videos about it, I had about 6 or 7 videos flagged, but I'm going to be honest, 3 or 4 of them deserved it. Nintendo Human Rhapsody is the one that was kind of borderline, because with that, I could have argued parody, but it's either satire or parody, and satire is not covered by fair use. Parody is. So it wasn't worth it at the time to go after it. I can't stack up to, you know, EMI's lawyers, but whatever. And a few others, though. Nintendo flagged me using like a few Super Mario 2 and Super Mario 3 songs on some old Flea Market Madness videos, right, having in the background for like 30 seconds. Didn't fight it. Probably can. Maybe win 1 or 2, but whatever. But this is a larger issue, though, because it seems like that on YouTube, there's no oversight on what's going on with the copyright flagging. That's a problem. And they can't have humans sitting there and judging each one, since there's millions and millions of YouTube videos, you know, hundreds of thousands being uploaded every day, you know. So I'm not sure what the solution is. What's to prevent other gaming companies from sweeping in and doing something similar? But this is the biggest one we've seen. But what if this was a guy who only had a few hundred subscribers? Maybe they wouldn't care because he doesn't have a big reach. But I'm just saying, in a theoretical world, that person
would get crushed,
and you wouldn't hear from him again, you know. But this is bad. What game company is this?
Fun. Look up Guise of the Wolf. GUISE. Fun something.
They're fucking assholes either way, because they actually threatened to take Total Biscuit's YouTube channel down.
Oh, they actually sent
or
him.
Or said, told
they,
him to
they,
do
they,
it.
They then
which
sent,
they can't do. They have no legal basis for doing.
They sent him a later email that said, remove the video, remove all your tweets about the situation, and take down your channel.
On what basis would that be done?
I don't
know.
There's been a lot of speculation, and it wouldn't surprise me if these were like some 18-year-old kids who really just don't get how this fucking shit works.
How the hell they make a video game?
Yeah, I heard, they didn't really make one. It wasn't really playable. But yeah, so I mean, I have no investment in Total Biscuit. I've seen maybe 2 of his reviews. I thought they were, you know, for what they were, YouTube videos, that's fine. But I do feel bad that there's a situation where these people who are trying to make their money in a new form of media have to deal with this sort of bullshit because people are petty. You know, if you can't handle, I mean, they've always said it, if you can't handle critique, you can't get into art. Whether you want to call video games art or not is whatever. But, you know, if you can't handle critique, then you shouldn't write. You shouldn't make music. You shouldn't make video games. You shouldn't make anything for public consumption if you can't handle critique.
We shouldn't be making a podcast.
Well, we probably shouldn't be making a podcast.
It's completely unnecessary. But, yeah, I guess we'll see how this plays out. But like you said, I mean, are they even both... is both Total Biscuit and this Fun Studios, what a great name, are they even both based in the same country? If not, trying to bring a slander or libel case is extremely hard in different countries.
And supposedly this company, I believe, is located in Jordan, is what they said. And, you know, Total Biscuit is located in the UK.
So, tell them to go after themselves, basically.
Right.
You know, and fortunately, if Maker Studios, and they should, go to bat for him, they'll have his back legally.
But apparently they do, like, when they came out and said that, when Fun Studios or whatever it was came out and said that it wasn't them, it seemed like Total Biscuit bought it for a tweet or two. And then the guy from Maker Studios, like one of the heads of Maker Studios, or guy, you know,
VP, it was a VP.
Yeah, VP chimed in and was like, nope, that was them. Like, absolutely.
It's still, this whole copyright YouTube issue is still sort of ironing itself out. It's not as bad as it was the first month. It was havoc for people. All of a sudden, people weren't making any money anymore. And you had, of course, some assholes saying, well, you shouldn't count on YouTube as a revenue stream. And it's like, why not? Now, YouTube's been around for like 6-7 years. And there's been ads on YouTube for like four and a half years now. Why can't it be a revenue stream for people? It's like anything else. It's a new form of media. Accept it. It's not going to go away, online, you know, media, especially streaming. So that's all I have to say. Like I said, my copyright issues, unfortunately, you know, me giving a bad review to, I don't know, The Last Starfighter, you know, I'm not going to have Mindscape coming after me, hopefully, you know.
I don't know if they're even around still.
But I'm just saying. But you're saying they'd have the power to try to shut me down because I'm talking trash about them. Jeez, James Rolfe would be in trouble then.
Yeah. That's for sure.
All right. What else is going on here? Did you see the Guardians of the Galaxy intro trailer?
I did. I think it's interesting for... Well, I thought it looked good. I thought it looked amusing enough that I'm going to go see it. I was pleasantly surprised that Rocket Raccoon does not look like complete and total shit.
He doesn't look like just a cartoon animal. He looks like a real... Yeah, for lack of a better term, he looks like a
Rocket
real...
Rocket Raccoon looks kind of actually exactly real. I'd expect him to. It's going to be fun to see a comic booky type popcorn movie take on intergalactic sci-fi for the first time in quite some time. Like, that's going to be a lot of fun. Just to switch it up, get us away from the normal superheroes, capes, saving the planet Earth sort of thing. That's going to be fun.
Well, let's explain what Guardians of the Galaxy is. It's a ragtag group of, like... It started, I think, in the 70s.
It's a rotating group, too.
And in the 70s, it was a totally different group than it was now.
Yeah.
I don't think they're even connected, really.
They're all... Howard the Duck was a member of Guardians of the Galaxy at one point.
So it's intergalactic, other side of the galaxy stuff. It's not really connected to the Earth, really.
No.
And they go... And they're a ragtag group of misfits, basically. It's a misfit superhero group, if you can call them that.
It's like West Coast Avengers in space.
All right, I think I'm not giving the West Coast Avengers enough credit, but all right. Iron Man was on the West Coast Avengers.
Everyone was the West Coast.
I love the West
Avengers.
Coast Avengers. Hank Pym and Tigra. Come on. You had Hawkeye on there.
I do like Hawkeye. Anyway, so, yeah. It's an outer space ragtag group, and it's going to be more... It's definitely going to be different than your usual what you think from that something from Marvel is going to be. This is not superheroes in any traditional sense of the word.
And I like it because, at least from the... The only thing I knew about it was that it existed. I mean, it's one of those titles where I collected comics as a teenager, so it'd be one of those things you might see, oh, there's Guardians of the Galaxy, flip through. That's all I knew. I never read one in my life.
Right.
Then you start hearing a few years back, yeah, they're making this movie with this, like, little furry raccoon that mouths off and shoots machine guns. You're like, oh, that sounds interesting. Like, they're really going to do something like that? And it's like, they're going to do a movie with not even B-listers, a bunch of C-list... You know, Marvel characters, it's like, okay, this is kind of strange. Like, I guess Marvel's kind of feeling good now. And if you even told me 4 years ago, you would not have a major... You'd have a Marvel movie coming out, like, this is big budget. This is like, you know, $150 million right. movie. This isn't cheap. If you told me then that you'd have a big Marvel movie coming out with a huge budget that wasn't a big superhero, like, this is like the same thing as if they did a Cloak and Dagger movie.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, this is... I'd say Cloak and Dagger are more well-known than Guardians of the Galaxy, at least overall in the history of comics they are. You know what I mean? So it's like... So it's surprising and it's cool because they're taking a risk. This isn't a slam dunk like Avengers, you know?
I want to see it do well because... I think I got this from a website, but someone referred to it as... Marvel's entering their deep cuts era.
Yes,
you know?
I saw that too. Yeah,
and I'm happy for that because that means we might get a Doctor Strange. We might get...
That's in the works.
We might get an Iron Fist, you know? I would love to
That's
see...
That's been rumored for 5-6 years.
I would love to see any of these. And I think by taking something so far out there like Guardians of the Galaxy, it's a barometer for them. If this can do it, then we can do it with anyone else in our universe.
Yes. It basically means it doesn't have to be an established character.
Right. If we can make these no ones from space something that makes us money, then we can take even slightly known characters.
And even though this is a comic that's existed since like for 30 plus years, in this iteration it's only been like 5 years or so, like in this sort of what they're
jumping off of. I'm not even sure. I know they rebooted it again recently, and here's the thing that's interesting to me. You know, people started getting hints of Guardians of the Galaxy when Marvel vs. Capcom came out and Rocket Raccoon was in there, okay? Marvel
vs.
Capcom 3.
Sort of slipped it in.
Right. There. And then, you know, Marvel started building it up and they started talking about, you know, possibly doing a movie. And everyone was like, oh, what is this? And then Marvel reboots it. And from everything I've heard, the Guardians of the Galaxy reboot is fucking trash. Like, no one likes it. But it doesn't matter because at this point, Marvel's movies... I mean, honestly,
they
have enough
matter.
Clout. People like them enough that it's going to stand on its own regardless of what's happening with the comic.
The good thing about Disney owning them, the comics could fucking not make a cent. It doesn't matter. The movies are going to make a ton of money.
So even if people didn't like the Guardians of the Galaxy comic, it doesn't really say anything about how well the movie's going to do.
Nothing.
Both in terms of its quality and people going to see it.
Because only 0.01% of the public has heard of it before the movie anyway.
Now, I could be wrong. I mean, I'd be willing to check out that comic, but I just haven't heard much good.
But that's why I like it, though. They're taking a risk from the trailer, intro, which is a perfect intro trailer. It doesn't give away the plot at all. It shows you who the characters are. It sets the tone, which trailers have forgotten to do that without giving away a plot.
Yeah, see, I liked the trailer for that because I actually don't watch trailers for movies I want to see because they always give away too much. Yeah. But this one, it was like, you don't know these characters, so here's a quick minute and a half intro to who they are.
The characters, and you get to see
a couple of snappy one-liners, Michael C. Reilly.
You screwing up the name is now screwing up me trying to correct you.
Something C. Reilly.
There's a lot of big actors in this.
Yeah.
You have Glenn Close in it. Mm-hmm. Benicio Del Toro, who actually had a cameo in the Thor 2 as the Collector. What's the main character, the guy from Parks and Recreation? Chris Pratt as Star-Lord. Chris Pratt's a guy who's on the rise, but he's not a household name.
No.
Parks and Recreation is a popular show. Hugely popular?
Yeah, I would say so.
You think it's hugely popular? Yeah, okay. But on that show, he wasn't even like a heartthrob. He was just schlubby guy. He gets this film. Marvel sees his acting chops. He was in Zero Dark Thirty, which I saw was excellent. He was a Navy SEAL in that. Probably had two lines in the last half hour of the movie. He was in Moneyball. Had a part in that. I think the first baseman. So he's been acting, but he's not a guy you put on this tentpole picture like this. But he gets the role. He gets ripped for it. And again, we talked about this in the past. I love Marvel Studios because they're not going out and getting leading men. They're getting out guys that they know can do the role.
Yeah, they're not getting brains or bronze or looks. They're casting to the role, and that is, well, fuck it, I'm not talking about it this week. But anyways, yeah.
You're not talking about what movie? What movie, Ian? Batman vs. Superman? You're not talking
about fill in the blanks.
But no, they got him, and they're surrounding the star with bigger actors.
Right.
John C. Reilly, not Michael C. Reilly.
Whatever.
Glenn Close, Benicio Del Toro, Michael Rooker has a role. Karen Gillian, who was in Doctor Who. Zoe Saldana as Gamora. And Vin Diesel as Groot. And the voice of Rocket Raccoon is Bradley Cooper. Awesome. So they're insulating their star, which is, again, smart. Their star, who's, on the rise, I think he's going to be in the new Jurassic Park movie that's coming out next year. So by the time that comes out, he'll be a hit. He'll be a rising star if he isn't already, and then by next year he'll be huge. But it's still, again, it looks interesting. They're taking an artistic risk, which is, again, why I love it. I think there is going to be a Doctor Strange movie, which I think will be great.
Yeah, I hope that my guess to their strategy is what their strategy is, because I think it's pretty good for companies sitting where they are. Cast the line so far out and then just reel it back in and catch everything. Catch everything.
Because this is probably the most outlandish comic movie they could do. Can you think of one more outlandish than this, other than like Devil Dinosaur?
No, like I'd love to see. Like I was gonna say Moon Knight, but no, Moon Knight would make more sense than this. Like I'll likely see. Like if this works,
Moon Knight is more well known than this.
Yeah, exactly. And I love Moon Knight, so there's a chance that maybe we will. Like if this works, like I said before, anything.
The sky's the limit.
Yeah.
All right. Well, it's August 1st. I'm gonna see it. This is gonna be a pretty cool next few months with Amazing Spider-Man 2, which I loved the first Amazing Spider-Man. I thought it was way better than all three Raimi Spider-Man films. You have X-Men Days of Future Past, which follows up the excellent First Class, which you still have to see.
Yeah, those I do need to see.
Captain America Winter Soldier looks great. It's probably better than the first one, because the first one has to deal with the origin, and that always takes forever.
Does Winter Soldier look cool?
That's where I'm going to end this segment.
All right, onwards.
Thanks for killing it.
You're welcome. All right. Anytime.
So we can talk about a few other things. We can do a short Q&A if you want. By the way, Q&A at CU Podcast, #, if you want to get your questions in. Live chat, listeners. This has come up somewhat before. And I'll tweet this out while you begin the discussion. The opinions of, I guess, the ethic basis, morality, if you will, of reproduction NES games that weren't released, I guess, in your region, or that were not released at all. Where do you stand on this, Ian?
The people who... Okay, first of all, I look at this as different than something like a burn. But let me... So, the first thing is, the people who were originally going to make money off of this are no longer making money off of it, whether you buy a legitimate copy of the game secondhand from Japan in the Japanese language, or you get an English translation reproduction card to play the game.
Sure.
Okay? So I don't really feel like you're stealing any money from anyone. I don't necessarily feel like people should necessarily profit off of someone else's work. Although, I also don't feel like paying them a little bit for soldering, wiring,
for their
flashing in the services is outlandish. Sure. I don't think that's a problem. I do take slightly more issue with destroying cartridges to make repros.
Like destroying a Batman Return of Joker to make a Mr. Gimmick.
But
I think it's despicable.
There's plenty of things that you can make from very common cartridges.
Sure.
Like double dribbles and Top Guns. So it's not a clear-cut yes or no answer. I think it's, you know, a very multifaceted answer. But at the base of it, if you want me to say, do I think there's a problem with someone playing a reproduction Sweet Home on their Nintendo? Something that you can't pass off as something that it isn't because it never existed. I don't have a problem with that at the base of it. I really don't.
Well, let's talk about who does it actually hurt. You alluded to it. It's something I actually brought up in my humorously over the top, in a way, in my Flintstone Surprises Dinosaur Peak review, how I was commenting about how you should emulate Flintstones Dinosaur Peak because scalpers have ruined the market on that. And so you're not really hurting anyone but those scalpers. You're not hurting... Taito doesn't give a shit. You know? They're out of that secondary market. The only ones it really affects are the people making those repro games and people that are involved with retro game stores. That's the only possible parties that it could affect.
And like I said, here's the thing. The pricing has got to get to a point where I think it's justifiable, where the person who's making it is getting compensated for their actual labor, because I know people who do this, and sure, it takes work, and their parts. But, you know, you don't, like I said, you don't want to making money off something that isn't theirs. Here's a good example. Look at texts that have entered the public domain, okay? One that I really like, The Divine Comedy, okay? Public domain, right? But you can go to Barnes & Noble and you
still
can
buy it.
And you can buy it. And sure, why? Because they had the foresight to fucking print it in a large volume and bind it and give it to you in a nice hardback.
Yeah, they're taking the financial initiative and risk and putting it out.
But they're only selling something like that. And The Divine Comedy is a thick book. You could kill an intruder with it. And it's tall. They're only charging like $10 for it. So sure, I don't feel bad because I'm not paying them for The Divine Comedy. I'm paying them to have a bound edition of it. Do you get what I'm saying? I think that's okay.
And the author who escapes me, when I read Dante's Inferno, he's dead. I don't think he's around anymore. So
Dante Alighieri.
Yeah, so he's gone. So he can't get any money. So it's the same thing.
Yeah, dead a long time.
Who gets affected? This is the way I look at it. This is kind of the way I always looked at piracy of music. And the way I justified it, at least to me, was I am not going out and buying the best of the disco era CD. If you put a gun to my head, I won't. So if I download a few disco songs, that's not money that would have went somewhere. It's in a void, as far as I'm concerned. That's the way I always looked at it.
I don't know. See, that to me is a bit trickier.
I'm not going out to even a secondhand store and buying the disco songs. I would just go without. Honestly, that's how I look at it. With the games, with the games, you can say I would have gone without too. But I think it's a little bit different because, at least with games versus music, and games, you spend a lot more time with games than with a 3-minute song. And it's a more interactive experience. And if you really want Mr. Gimmick, like on a system to play like me, I think your options are limited when it comes to that.
Sure. So, you know, repro carts of something that was clearly never released here.
Mr. Gimmick.
With the caveats that I had mentioned before, I really have no massive problem with it.
Sure.
You know, don't overcharge for it, but at the same point in time, don't be the person who overpays for it. And kind of be mindful of what you're buying. If you know that they had to sacrifice something rare and hard to come by for it, then don't. You know, but as time goes on, we're going to find mass-produced boards that are going to allow people to do reproductions easier.
Well, you can buy them now.
Yeah, I know.
Mass-produced, but you can buy them.
But, I mean, you know, eventually you'll get them. I'm sure you'll get them cheaper.
You think you'll get to the point where you'll have a board ready to go with a device that you can just flash anything you want to it?
Yes,
easily?
I do.
You think
you'll
get to that point?
Yeah. So I really think that's possible. I think we're going to get to the point where we don't have to worry about what it's damaging, and then you just have to make sure that, you know, you're okay with, you know, the transaction that's going on. If you feel comfortable with it, then go for it.
Sorry, I'm distracted. I don't see my Mr. Gimmick cart, so I'm freaking out here.
I don't know. Jesus Christ. Can we focus on the podcast for a minute?
No! So when it comes to repro labels, that's where probably me and you agree that that's a lot different.
Okay, that's very different.
A lot different. This is why. Go.
Okay, here's my first thing. Before we even get talking into if they should be okay or not, let me ask anyone who's a collector. Here's my problem with repro labels. I don't believe that anyone who actually says they want them to replace a label is either honest or can qualify themselves as a collector. And here's why. Look at things like antiques. Look at other collectibles, okay?
Sure.
If you do refurbishing work on an old antique table, you take the value of it down because it's no longer what it was.
It's not the original.
If someone had reproduction sleeves for all of my Brian Eno records, I'd say, no, I don't want them. It doesn't matter how pristine they look because it's not the original thing.
It's like comic books when you get them restored. The value drops precipitously.
You take what you can, like this F-15 City War with its dings, it's its character, but it's original. Sure. So if you're telling me that you want to do that for your collection, then I'm going to tell you you're not a collector because then you're far more concerned about aesthetics than anything else. And that's fucking ridiculous. Two, if that's
here's a big thing, too. The label, it does not affect the gameplay at all.
No.
It doesn't affect the game.
But here's my other thing, and this is where people will argue it. So put something on there that says reproduction, right? They're like, no, it doesn't look the same. No, if all you're doing it for is so that you can tell yourself that your label looks prettier, then you should not matter if there is some distinguishing mark in some corner that someone can check for that says reproduction. If someone looks at it at a glance, they're not going to notice, but at least then people like myself, other buyers, resellers, know what to look out for so they know they're not getting bullshit.
And that's what I don't like, and that's why when you have these douchebags now selling repro Flintstones Dinosaur Peak labels on eBay to replace the damaged labels, like there's so many damaged labels of carts out there for Flintstones Dinosaur Peaks that they have like 30 available at once for sale for $5 a pop, you are now affecting something that's a lot different than a repro cart that's obviously different. You're now affecting the secondary market more directly because now you have potential for scamming, potential for people getting ripped off.
Right.
That's a lot different than a repro cart where it's very hard to get ripped off by a repro cart because it looks different on the outside and the inside.
Right. If someone comes into me, say, at work, and they put down Wanpaku graffiti in a Nintendo case, and they put down a Flintstones Dinosaur Peak, I can immediately look at the Wanpaku graffiti and go, okay, cool repro, dude. I'll give you, what'd you pay? Let me look it up. I'll give you a few bucks. Someone will buy it. That's fine. But the Dinosaur Peak, I'm going to look at and be like, I don't even... Dude, at this point, I got to tell you, if someone brought a Dinosaur Peak into me, I'd probably send it back with them. I probably would not trust them on it. Well, or I'd open it up.
You have to open it up.
I'd open it up. But I just... It honestly wouldn't be worth the hassle.
You might as well open up and call your good buddy Pat down to verify it,
I can verify it myself. Thank you very much.
Well, I have one I could look at. Match it against. Plus, I don't know. That's hurt in the market. I think that's hurt some of the... We talked about the peak of maybe the Hind NES games. Who knows? There's a guy named Games381. His name's John, who I actually know. He's a guy on YouTube. He does pretty good reviews of like systems and old games. And he talked about recently how NES is no longer fun to collect for because the value is just so high and it's hard to get the games. And I know we talked about collecting a lot before, but I think if it gets to that point, you have to look in the mirror and say, why are you collecting games?
Yeah, you have to reassess why you're doing this. This is my response to that. If you wanted to talk about the TurboGrafx, or better example, Neo Geo AES, okay? You can look at the Neo Geo AES and be like, yeah, everything's way too fucking expensive. The barrier to entry is really expensive. And the games that I can buy for the money have been re-released a million times elsewhere for, $19 for a pack of 20, okay? To a lesser extent, Turbo is getting really expensive, and it's a small library, okay? But you know what? The Nintendo library is 750-plus games.
Tons of games.
And there's 100 really great games that you can get for under $15.
Ninja Gaiden, $8 game.
Right. Yeah, tons. I'm just saying tons. So if... I think that's bullshit. If you're collecting to be a completionist, if you have to have every one, yeah, it's getting a bit pricey.
Gunsmoke, awesome game. What
amazing
is it? $7
game? $7
game. $6.
Yeah. So if you just want to play games, if you want to make your own little curated collection, I would say don't buy that. That doesn't mean... I understand to a degree. I don't love it, but I understand what he's saying.
Sure.
For a certain type of collector. But for the type of person who comes, say, into Luna, who just wants to play some Nintendo games and have some fun and play some old school shit, no, there's still plenty of great stuff that you can get for a reasonable price.
I'm looking at Cobra Triangle right there.
I don't know why. That game's awful.
You don't like Cobra Triangle?
No, I fucking hate Cobra Triangle. I think it gets shitty real quick.
But I think it's fine. That's like a $3 game.
Adventures of Dino Ricky, Lolo, Lolo 2. Even Lolo 3 is not that expensive.
We're just going through the whole library of games. Bionic Commando, $10 game.
Balloon
Excellent.
Fighter, Stanyax, DuckTales.
Some people like Goonies 2. That's a $3 game.
Goonies 2.
I'm just saying, I don't like Ghoulies 2.
Faxanadu is like the... Faxanadu and Batman are two of like my favorite games on the system, you know, and they're $5.
You can't afford the $12 for baseball stars. Get Little League Baseball.
Right.
That's a great baseball game.
I think it's... If you're a completionist collector, sure, then the market's getting harsh for you.
But if you're a gamer... there's some people that are gamers slash collectors. They should be fine.
You're fine.
They should be fine. Way too many games.
You could probably... I cut my collection down from 400 to 100. You could probably get up to 300 without breaking much of a monetary sweat right now.
You know what? You want to do this? This is semi-piracy. Go out and get yourself a multi-car, a Supervision, for like $35, $30, $20. You get 100 games. There's a lot of cool games on there if you want to do that. You know, if you don't care about having the actual game you want to play. But again, I think that's where it lies. That's why, unfortunately, when you talk about collecting... Some people say they're separate from gamers. I think it's hard to separate it unless you are totally someone that doesn't care about the games at all. Then, obviously, you're just a collector. But, no, the library is too big.
That's my main thing. The library is not uniformly expensive, like something like the AES. And the library
or TurboGrafx, even.
Yeah. And the library is not ridiculously small, like the TurboGrafx. There's a whole ton of games out there.
They don't have to all be Little Samsons. You know, the few games that are both... You know, very good. Expensive and good.
That's the other thing I think people forget.
There's not that many of these.
And there's a joke on online.
Yeah, my label's not bad.
Keep bragging. Amongst collector circles, the rarest games, the ones that are going to cost you the most money, oftentimes aren't the most fun to play. There's a reason why a lot of these are rare.
That's the reason why I hate stadium events.
Yeah. Little Samson is, you're right, it's a great game. It's one of the few that's actually, you know, really
Death
fun
Race.
And expensive.
Oh, excuse me, it's a Shockwave. Or it could have been Death Race. It looks exactly the same. They're both games by ACGI,
yeah, except
right?
The fact that Death Race would be
they're
with
all
the
fucking
D's.
Terrible. But it's the same. There's only five games that look like this, and Chiller. They're all terrible, but they're expensive. That's my point. Actually, this used to be a game that only cost like $10.
Yeah, I actually bought Shockwave for $10.
Why?
I don't know. I got rid of it soon after.
The NES is a deep library. The reason I love it, because there's games in there that I even forget are games.
Yeah.
They're like, wow, that's a cool game.
Every year during the marathon, there's something that pops up. I'm like, I know we've played this before, but I always forget about it.
The first marathon, we play Eliminator Boat Duel.
That's a fantastic game.
It's a fantastic game. It's like a $4 game. It's a great game that we didn't even know about, really, until we started playing. Like, wow, this is a fantastic game.
Yeah.
You know.
So anyways, yeah, that's my take on that.
Yeah, I think when it happens with anything, you have to just take a step back, breathe, and then play some games. Just play them. I know I can say that being that there's not any more games for me to buy, but I mean, just take a step back and just relax, and then
look around and realize that you probably haven't touched fucking 90% of what you have. If you're a collector who's gotten to the point who says that the Nintendo is no longer fun because of the price, that means you've bought up the bottom 400 games that didn't cost you anything. Have you played them? Have you had fun with them? Have you done anything besides buy them and look at them?
I don't like that accusing look you're giving me right now. Ian.
That's an accusing look I'm accused giving everyone, but it's easy for me to give it to you.
I played all these for the marathon,
I know,
damn it.
Shut up. That's my saving grace. I'm not attacking you, but, you know, sit down and play what you have. Like, there's
not just that. There are still places to find deals. It's not all eBay.
No, it's not.
And I know there's a billion more times. Someone told me, or I saw the term scalping versus reselling. Scalping's perfect, because... If you sell, that's fine. If you scalp, you're an asshole. There's so many more game scalpers than there used to be that popped up the past 4 years. There's ways around that still. There's still people. There's still... You go out to these conventions, Retro Gaming Expo. There's the Midwest Gaming Classic Expo. There's a ton of these things. There's one in Seattle. You can find people there to trade with, or you find good deals. You actually find people willing to get rid of their doubles for cheap. You know.
Well, you realize that, you know, bubbles and things like this rise and fall, so... Hey, you know what? Play the good games you've got. Go and fill in the blanks of your sports games that no one wants, and then when the prices start to fall a little bit more, get in and get the stuff that you wanted to get. Like, I don't know. You don't have to give up on collecting just because things are getting expensive. Look to imports. You know? Famicom games, a lot cheaper than Nintendo games. PC Engine games, rising in price a little bit, but still considerably cheaper than most Turbo games. Like, sure. There are so, you know, if it's not for a collection, if it's not for a set, there are still plenty of ways that you can... enjoy your hobby.
There's always a Batman you can get for like $3.
Such a good game.
There's always a Batman you can get. It's one of the best games on the system. And it's not Little Samson. I'd rather play this than Little Samson. Sorry, would. But $3.
Kabuki Quantum Fighter. I'll meet you in the middle.
Kabuki Quantum Fighter?
Yeah.
I totally forget what that game is.
You whip with your red hair.
That's right. You love that game. We always played it.
It has a freaking bizarre ass aesthetic. Anyways, so yeah, that's
there. You go.
We talk about this stuff all the time, but there's kind of the last word on a lot of it.
I love John Gamester. Love seeing him at conventions. I talk to him on the phone sometimes. Haven't in a while, but I think I mean his collecting part. I think he's just got to go back to the library. Go back to the library, play some games, have fun with it.
Make yourself some popcorn and some chocolate milk, and sit down and grab a stack of games and play. Just play.
Just play. That's the message for today.
Alright. Yeah, we have to start and pick and choose just because we get a lot of questions, and if we don't answer your question, no offense, but chances are if we skip your question, it's probably because we've answered it in a past Q&A session.
This is a good one. We'll start with this one first. This is from at Foxhounder1014. He writes for the Punk Effect. Oliver, hey Oliver. This is for you real quick. I don't care about this series. I don't. I mean, it's fun, but whatever. What are your opinions on the Metal Gear series? It's personally my favorite of all time, especially Metal Gear Solid 3.
I really liked Metal Gear Solid 1. I loved it when it came out. I have not really played much of the series after that. I think what Kojima was doing, especially back then, not so much now, but especially back then with the way he worked his narratives and constantly tricked the players, was very, very clever. I keep telling myself that one of these days I'm going to go buy the complete Metal Gear set that you can get for PS3. I'm going to sit down and I'm going to play them all and I'm going to enjoy them. Will I ever actually do it? No, probably not. But I do respect the games. They don't ever enter my queue.
By the way, he's writing a fictional sort of Metal Gear series on the site right now.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah. Narrative first one's out. It's good.
Cool.
Check it out on the Punk Effect from at Foxhounder. 1014. It's from Jeron. Hey, Jeron. This could be a little mini topic. How crude is too crude when it comes to video game humor? We're talking beyond Duke Nukem Forever. Okay, I'll answer this by this. I'll just say, in general, comedy or whatever, I'm of the opinion stance that it's either all acceptable or none of it. I think if you can tell jokes in a way, as long as it's funny, it's funny. If it's not, that's your problem. When it comes to video games, video games is a different medium than comedy, though, because there's more involved than just, it's more interactive. But honestly, I don't care about crude humor if it's done well. If it's done well, it's fine. If it's not done well, it's not fine. Yeah. That's what it comes down to.
I don't give a shit about crude humor. It's when it's not done well that it's the problem with crude humor is when it falls flat, all you're left with is crude. When a normal joke falls flat, well, whatever, it just falls. So, you know, you look at something like Duke Nukem Forever where it was just garbage. You know, it makes the game worse. And then you look at something
But that would have been garbage regardless of the humor.
Right.
The humor could have been,
I look at a game like Shadows of the Damned, and it didn't suffer because of its humor. It suffered just because I didn't feel like it was completely fleshed out. But the humor wasn't spot on. Like, normally in Suda 51's games, you know, even if things are crude, like, there's some thought to it or whatever, but, like, it just fell flat. I guess that's the end of it. If crude humor falls flat, you feel like the game was written by a 7-year-old. If it's actually funny, though, I don't know. I have no problem with it. We're adults. You can make a good piss or fart joke, and I'm going to laugh. But if you make a shitty one...
Yeah. If you're going to offend, just make sure you're funny.
Yeah.
I guess it's a rule.
That's really the main rule. If you're going to be offensive, you better make damn sure you're funny about
it. Exactly. This is from at Jace Nakarado. Nakarado. This is a quicker one. One game you still cannot beat to this day that you struggled for when you were younger.
You know, I still can't one credit complete R-Type, and that drives me fucking nuts.
That sounds tough. R-Type's tough.
It is. I can make it all the way to like level 5 on like one ship, and then I completely fall apart.
No, I feel bad, Ian. For me, I can't really figure right now. I think I've gotten better at some games. I've gotten better throughout my aged youth. I've gotten better at Mike Tyson's Punch-Out, but worse at Ninja Gaiden somehow. I'm not sure how that works, but that's what's happened. Not sure I have to think about that. Huh. All right. This is from at Mega5K. She's in the chat right now. What do you think about Nintendo making a YouTube channel aimed towards girls in gaming? Do you think that it's sexist? I've not heard about this.
I think it's really, really kind of misguided. I don't know. It's just
guided more than sexist?
It's just... Well, sexist, too. It's just weird. I don't like... It's the whole fucking thing is weird.
Is it going to be pink with kittens
it's
all over?
Really, really it's really over-the-top girly. And it's like, you don't understand Nintendo. Like, you're seen as this, like, clean... squeaky kind of all-inclusive area where I've never once thought of Nintendo as being for boys or girls, you know? Never once, not even in my most sexist. I look at, like, the Xbox 360, right? And I see a bunch of fat fucking slobs shoving Doritos in their goddamn maw playing something, right? And I'm like, man, girls don't play this. And I'm like, man, that's sexist. Of course girls play it. But I've never thought that about Nintendo. I always look at Nintendo, I'm like, anyone plays Nintendo. Why? Because Nintendo's always portrayed themselves as being more open. Going so far to make a girls' channel for Nintendo, I think that's got... It's weird at the very least, and possibly alienating. I don't know. I mean, maybe someone else will chime in. I think it's strange.
Could this be a full topic next week? Or next time?
I don't know. The thing is that I've heard, and I haven't looked at a lot of it, is... I guess it is aimed at, younger girls, like kids, like preteens and teens. And maybe that's more interesting to them, but I still feel like the dividing of gender was never something that Nintendo needed to do.
Yeah, the Mario and Zelda games are big examples of games that appeal to everyone. There's no age limits, there's no sex limits.
And just like I said, there's no sex limit on enjoying Halo or Call of Duty or anything like that, but I especially never thought of that with Nintendo.
Right. Well, maybe they're that desperate from their sales of 4 Wii U's last year. Next question. This is from at Cartridge Brothers. Which gaming franchise, if canceled, retired, have the biggest impact on gaming today? That's an interesting question. That's a very tough question. That's not easy to answer.
Here's the
problem. That's basically saying what's the most influential one.
So I guess here's my issue. A lot of the bigger ones that I think would have been easy answers years ago have already, dug their own graves. So for instance, it would have been really easy to say that, Final Fantasy back when 7 or 8 came out, right? Mm-hmm. But no one takes Final Fantasy seriously anymore. The game series is a joke. You could say Mario Brothers, but and that's close, but at this point the influence has been taken from Mario. I think everything that people want to learn from Mario has been absorbed. So if Mario disappeared now, it's not like Mario's teaching anyone new tricks. There's still great Mario games being made, and no one else is making platformers quite like that. But I think its influence is no longer.
Best answer is there's so many games on so many consoles. I don't think getting rid of one will matter because there's so many. Plus, there's so many ones that are like others. I mean, that's really tough. That's really tough question.
It's weird too because you don't see people rallying around one title like you used to. When Final Fantasy VII came out, for instance. Everyone bought it. Mm-hmm. I mean, in my high school, everyone got it, whether they were sports gamers or nerds.
It was the game to get.
You don't see a lot of games like that now. Even though people go crazy for something like Grand Theft Auto 5, there's still a whole group of people who are just never going to pick that up. So I don't know. It's tough. It is a good question. I think if you furthered it if you removed an entire franchise's influence.
Yes.
That's the thing. That's a more important question.
The influence of GTA is one of the biggest.
Right. The influence of GTA would be huge.
But that's already there. You already have all the copycats and games that are like that, Saints Row.
If you add a little bit to the question, and you just say you eliminate all their influence as well, I'd say GTA and Mario Brothers would be two of the bigger ones. I don't even like GTA, but I'm not going to say its influence is not there, because it is.
It's probably the most influential game of the past 15
of the 3D era, probably. Mario 64, I didn't like it. That opened up 3D worlds, then you got GTA, which gave you true open world.
There you have it. So we turned that question around. he gets one question. House of Cards... Oh, he gets both, fine. House of Cards Season 2, yes, I love House of Cards Season 1 Netflix. Excellent series.
I need to watch it.
This is from a shipwreck_00. Are you guys fans of the Dreamcast? If so, what's the game that sticks out most for you?
I'm a huge fan of the Dreamcast.
I like it.
Trick. The game that sticks out the most for me is Jet Set Radio.
Great game.
It's probably the only game that I've beaten more than 10 times.
Really? You never told me that.
I had the import version, beat it like 7 or 8 times, got the US version, beat it a couple times, and then beat the Japanese version more times.
I'll say it again. The reason I consider Dreamcast the last retro system is because the last one that had its games displayed in an arcade. And vice versa.
Sure.
Games like Crazy Taxi, I can play it at so much. It's so fun. Soul Calibur was the first time I saw Soul Calibur on a TV and had it look exactly like the arcade. I was like, holy shit.
Oh, and Phantasy Star Online is huge. I mean, that was the first console game that it was the first console RPG that you could go online. Like, that game sticks out so much in my head, to the fact that we're still playing clones of it to this day. Like, I just got a game in the mail, Gundam Breaker, the other day, that is a Phantasy Star Online clone, only plays Gundam models. Like, so there's a lot of games that started on that system that, you know, stick out for me.
This is at X-Files 2000-1999. The debate of biblical proportions is happening in a Facebook group. Which games do you include when considering complete NES collection? It's whatever you want it to be.
Yeah. Because
some people don't include unlicensed games. Some people include unlicensed games. Some people only include the Tengen games, because the only games you can find at Toys R Us. You know, whatever the hell you want. Some people include Nintendo World Championships. Some people don't. Some people, I personally include any game that was available via retail stores. So that means, via retail, I don't include Flintstones Dinosaur Peak even, because that was not available on Toys R Us. I don't include the Panesian games. You couldn't find those for sale anywhere. You can only find those in a CD rental store.
Yeah.
You know, so I don't include the NWC carts. So I include games I own. It doesn't matter to me.
Because I have a very different take on collecting, your collection is done when the compulsion stops itching.
Exactly. That's part of it, too. If I wanted Stadium Events, I'd have one by now. Right. I would have bought it. I would have bought a Stadium Events 5 years ago, or 4 years, when I really finished up my collection in February 2010. When I finished it up then, or yeah, 2010, I could have got a Stadium Events then for like whatever, $600-$700, $1,000. Right. I would have done it then. I didn't feel the need to, because I not only hate the game, I don't want it.
So, I mean, if you want to really know what is considered a full set of retail releases, there's hard numbers you can find online, but my opinion is just when you're done having fun, your collection is done.
Hey, Ian, at Radical, at Gantor1313.
Hey, guy.
Hey, Ian.
Oh, hi, you. I know you now.
What's your experience and thoughts on the Wonder Swan? Any cool exclusive games for it?
Very little, but there was a pretty neat Guilty Gear. The second one, I think, was pretty decent. There's a Klonoa game for it that was pretty good. And those limited edition Final Fantasy 1 and 2 Wonder Swan colors they did were pretty badass.
At Ray Peterson, 24. Pat, ever wanted to work at Luna for fun? Would you be Employee of the Month? Ian, thoughts on Pat being his go-to sales rep?
Shit can, day one.
I think someone suggested I should work there for a day. I would honestly do that. Two tweet question. During the early episodes of Pat the NES Punk videos, how long did it take for fans to realize you weren't just a AVGN clone and was instead someone who had an alternate approach to reviewing NES games?
I'm still wondering that.
I mean, that's a weird question, because yeah, I still have people saying, oh, AVGN ripoff on like a video last week. I don't know. It probably, honestly, delineation point was really, it's kind of weird. You kind of look at my videos in a way that the first 2 years is one segment, and then it kind of jumps off when I moved here, which was only a year in, but after that first year, I still was editing videos I shot here. And then I went to SGC 2010. And if SGC is inviting you to have a panel, you're not an AVGN clone, because he was the face of Screw Attack still in 2010. Right. So maybe that's the point. As Sinus Destroyer, who's moderating the chat. Hey, Matt, what are your favorite LGN games?
What up, Matt?
Punisher, Wooden Water Rage, if we're talking NES, Alien 3, really good on the Super Nintendo, NES not as much. Off the top of my head,
Karate Kid. I really like Karate Kid. I really don't think it's that awful. I guess that would be mine.
At Duke Jaywalker 22, what do you want to happen to your game / record collection if you should suddenly and tragically die? Well, that's a nice thought. Auction off piece by piece for charity, or left with a trusted caretaker to be kept intact for all time?
I would leave it with someone I cared about. I wouldn't really want them sold off for charity. That's a good thing, but here's the deal. My records aren't going to get much for charity. Just being my records, it's not going to increase the value. So I know people who like my music taste. You know, Vani, my fiance, really likes a lot of them. I'd rather they just went with her, you know? If they could be put to good use for charity, I'd be okay with that. I just don't want them sold off in a garage sale or binned.
Yeah, that's the thing. I want a collector that really knows to have it.
Yeah, I want them to mean whoever they mean something to. That's who I want to have them.
Except for my M82, which is going in my grave. All right, I'll go faster here. This is from Etso Dawson. Do you consider the DuckTales Gold Cart Capcom made for the remaster release to be an official cart / mission? No, it's because it's not. It's a DuckTales game. No, that's not even a DuckTales game. What am I talking about?
What are you talking about? You're talking about the gold cart.
The one that came out with last year, right? For the release.
It's actually DuckTales.
They cannibalized real DuckTale cars.
It's a reproduction board.
That's right. They got a repro board. So yeah, it's not. It's a repro game.
No, I don't count that at all.
It's not an official release.
Do I think it's cool? Yeah. Do I think it's ever going to go for money? Unfortunately, is it at all part of a Nintendo collection? No.
You'll like this one. At Zack Attack 1984. What's the deal with Nintendo Age? They bite your head off if you say anything bad about sealed slash VJ collectors, and they always argue. Well, a lot of them are dicks. Some are cool. I'm not going to say that. I met some cool guys like Justin Penguin. Great guys in Nintendo Age. Some are just assholes.
Lincoln's from... Look, just walk away. Just walk away from that shit. Don't get involved in those discussions. It's not worth it. Have your opinion and leave.
They're arguing the thing about sealed slash VGA stuff because... That's what they see their nest egg being, is sealed games. A lot of those guys, they're not video game collectors. A lot of those are guys that came from the world of sports cards, toys,
investments in general,
and other investments that are vultures that are coming into video games and trying to make that their new piece of their monetary gain.
Right,
call it like it is.
Just because some of these people are on a board called Nintendo Age does not mean they know anything about video games.
No.
It means that this is a place they know where they can go get info on what they're buying, selling, and trading.
They know how to take a game. You know, to find a sealed game on eBay, buy the game for $50, send it away, get slabbed, and try to flip it for $400. That's what they know. That's where their knowledge begins and ends. They know price trends. They don't know shit about video games.
Yeah.
Next question. Yo, can't find the link of the CU podcast.
Oh, well.
At Gara at my desert.
Helen.
V-Day is over, mm-hmm. But who's your favorite and least favorite video game couple? Even non-gaming related, if you wish. That's a tough one.
I
never bought the Mario Princess Toadstool thing for a second.
Yeah, that's kind of like my least favorite video game.
Never bought
couple.
It.
Driver and Car from City Connection.
Wait, there's a couple in there?
Driver and Car.
Oh, you mean the combination?
Yeah.
Cat and Windshield?
I don't know. It's been a long time since I've played RPGs. Oh, okay. Potential spoiler coming up about Final Fantasy IX.
Oh,
ready?
God. Okay,
ready?
Okay.
10 seconds.
Well, let's...
Favorite video game couple is Vivi and Queena when they have their mock wedding in Final Fantasy IX.
I know nothing about Final Fantasy in Glad.
Okay, spoiler over.
Okay. This is from at CJonathan0329. What are your thoughts on South Park, The Sake of Truth? I think it's going to be excellent when it finally gets released. It's been delayed, a full year? It was supposed to come out last year. They actually made fun of it on South Park a few weeks. Whenever the last episodes aired, they actually referenced it at the end because they had a 3-part Game of Thrones episode and referenced it, saying it'll come out eventually. I think it's going to be cool because there's been so many references to fantasy stuff on that show in the past. I think they're fans of that genre. They're writing it themselves and have a lot of.
I think the writing is going to be good. I think that they have enough interest in that sort of material, video games, that their hearts are going to be in the right place.
They've done multiple video game episodes on South Park.
I think that because it got bounced from studio to studio because of delays, I do have concerns about how it's actually going to play. But I think if you're a fan of South Park and RPGs in general, it's not going to be worthless to you. I think you're going to have fun with it.
I think it's something I would pick up. Is it going to come out on current gen consoles?
Yeah, next month. And I'll probably pick it up too.
I think I will. The first new game I bought in 4 years. Hey, Pat, what's your favorite Dungeons & Dragons games that came out for the NES? Wow, well, God, I always have trouble differentiating them. I love Dragon Strike because it's an action game. It's kitschy, you know. I don't know the difference between Hillsfar and the other one, you know.
Hillsfar has some interesting ideas. None of them are really...
One's a dungeon crawler, one's a regular RPG, right? And
one's an action game. One is Heroes of the Lance, which is obtuse and ridiculous. and then I think it's Pools of Radiance is more of a traditional dungeon crawler.
Is that the one's dungeon crawler?
And then Hillsfar is a mixture of things.
Okay.
Hillsfar is interesting.
Which is the one that has you going on horses?
Hillsfar is that's one
that's
part
the
of
mixture
Hillsfar.
Of it. Okay.
That's definitely interesting. I don't remember it being particularly great.
At Squirrel Mafia, which has the better sequel, DuckTales or Rescue Rangers?
DuckTales, hands down.
And a couple more. At CJonathan0329, have you played Bravely Default yet? And if so, did you like it? I have not. I keep seeing the name of this game. I don't think I've seen one video shot of it.
It's Final Fantasy Returns. It's basically Square's new final. It's Square's new RPG that will probably be a series where they get to do Final Fantasy things in it while Final Fantasy continues to.
It's older Final Fantasy.
Yeah, basically.
It's Final Fantasy from the SNES era, basically.
Well, PlayStation 1 era, too. Like, it's more of a traditional JRPG. I really want to play it. There's a lot that came out this week that I really want to play. I don't have time to play everything I want, but I really want to play like Bravely Default, Danganronpa on the Vita. I want to play Earth Defense Force 2025. Now's a good time to be into... Now's a good time to have some handhelds.
And our last question, at PieLover... 1325. Who doesn't love pie? Ever plan on having quests on the podcast? Should we have some quests? The quest for Pat's missing Mr. Gimmick card at this point has drive me nuts.
The quest for sobriety.
The quest for sobriety. The quest for ending this before 10:30, which we're going to do this podcast.
I think that was probably meant to be guests.
Oh. That makes it... I think
quest is
funnier.
I thought you kind of assumed that. I do too.
I want to have a quest.
We've answered this question in brief before, and I'll say the same thing. I don't want to have guests right now. I like that it's as simple as it is with us two. I think we play off each other well enough. I get to get out of work, come have a beer, and we're done. I think guests would be fun, but it's not something I'd want to do regularly.
No.
And it's going to make it a bigger hassle.
Yes, because we are on the West Coast, and we start late because Ian, you work. And so if we have someone on the East Coast, it's midnight for them when we start. Right. And then there's a setup. You got to get them hooked in on Skype. That's the only way to do it. I've actually thought about having people calling in via Skype and setting up an account, but we don't have anyone to screen them. So we can have a joker come on and do whatever. So it's a little complicated having more... Unless you have a producer help you. A lot of the big podcasts, like Steve Austin's podcast, the Joe Rogan Experience, the huge ones, they have guys behind the scene. They have at least one or two people helping out produce the show.
Yeah.
It's me producing this on the fly. You know, that's why people say, why are you always on the computer? I'm monitoring the chat. I'm monitoring, make sure we're streaming. I'm monitoring Ustream. I'm monitoring the topic. So, like, to have someone else helping out would be great.
I should rephrase. I'm not an anti-guest, but we would definitely need help for it to work out. And I would only want to do it at most, like, once every few podcasts.
Unless we did a special time when it wasn't on the regular podcast and we sort of spliced it in and showed people during the... You know what I mean? Like, something like that where it was, like, a one-off. That's fine.
Yeah, I mean, I'm sure we'll get there. It's just, right now, I like where we're at. And people... I mean, I appreciate that people enjoy the podcast, but we're still pretty young for a podcast.
It's been 6 months.
So, probably 12 episodes. You know, I mean...
More than that. It's been, like... 6 months. Oh, you're right. It's been more than that, I think. August, September, October, November, December.
Whatever. January, math is for losers.
I can't count. Yeah, maybe 12 episodes.
You know, I mean, once we get a bit more situated, then yeah, maybe.
All right. We're cool. We got through this. Do the CU podcast end in dance. All right. With that said, we're going to see you guys in 2 weeks' time. We will see you on Wednesday, March 5th, if you want to come here live. Remember, hashtag CU Podcast. We'll have this on the site the next day, which will be Thursday, and then we'll have clips on YouTube throughout the week. We don't like putting them all at once because we don't want to saturate YouTube, folks. They'll get pissed. So,
do you ever do reviews anymore?
No, I don't.
The comment section is pretty hilarious on some of those. People are like, why is my feed full? Because you subscribe to him. You subscribe to him, so therefore you get what he puts out.
You can unsubscribe if you want, you know? This is one of my first things I did. Didn't college. I had a radio show for 3 years in college. Well, 2.5 years. But,
I talked to myself for 3 years around college time.
I wish that was a joke. And with that, we're going to see you next time. For Ian Ferguson, my name is Pat Contry. Have a pleasant evening. Finish your cerveza. Bye-bye, everybody. Bye.